Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Catherine Bloom. Bloom is a playwright, actor, and activist. She has appeared off-Broadway in such plays as The Seagull and The Country Wife. She is an artistic associate at the Vermont Stage Company in Burlington, where her play Vanya Vermont premiered in 2005. She is the co-founder of the Lysistrata Project, a worldwide theatrical event for peace, from which sprang her one-woman show, The Accidental Activist, currently at Ithaca's Kitchen Theater through May 13th. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listen, I want to begin because I often wonder in this exceedingly high-tech, machine-oriented world, what is it that still attracts someone to wanting to go into an old-fashioned thing like theater?
Well, it's something that I've always wanted to do ever since I was a little kid. And I don't think I really distinguished between stage or TV and film. I remember as a very small child, we almost moved to Boston, and I was really excited because that was where they made Zoom. And I wanted to be a Zoom kid. And, you know, so it's more sort of the performing arts in general.
Uh-huh.
But over the years, I spent more time in the theater than I have doing film and TV. And while I enjoy all the media. I love the energy of live performance.
Mm-hmm.
And
I know there is nothing like
the relationship to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very comfortable in front of a large group of people. And I'm one of the few actors who actually enjoys public speaking. I have always seemed to have a knack for engaging. I'm very shy one-on-one sometimes, but when you get me in front of, 500 people, it's not such a big deal. And I think that now doing a solo performance piece where a lot of it is direct addressed to the audience kind of combines those two things.
Uh-huh. And then when did you discover that you could meld activism with theater? Because it's such a powerful way to do it.
Yeah. Well, when I was in college, I went thinking I would probably want to do theater because I'd been doing that all the way through high school, but I also loved science and biology, and I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. And then my second semester senior year, my roommate, this is freshman year, got us into an upper-level seminar in the anthropology department, and it was a course about how different landscapes will affect the evolution of different cultures and then how the cultures will in turn affect those landscapes. And we started out with Kung Bushmen and hunter-gatherers and things like that. But then, he had us reading, he had an agenda, and he had us reading the Global 2000 Report and Wendell Berry and really putting together the interconnected nature of the world's environmental problems and the gravity of them. And I thought, oh my God, I can't be in good conscience a citizen of the planet and not want to do something about it. And yet, the other thing that I really, really cared about was theater. And so I ended up designing my undergraduate degree in theater and environmental studies.
I noticed that. Very interesting.
And my sort of thesis around all of that was people tend not to address problems until they become crises because they're so busy with their lives and going about their daily business. But the gift of theater is that it engages people both intellectually and emotionally. And if you can tell people a story that happens to be set in the context of an environmental issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not want to do sort of agitprop street theater. I had done that in high school around nuclear disarmament, and
that's not
really what I was interested in. But I thought if you can create really high-quality theater that tells a good story that happens to be within a particular context that you want to talk about, then you end up, for the audience member, building both an intellectual and an emotional relationship to that issue so that perhaps the next time when they hear about it in real life, they're more likely to have a more fully engaged response.
Yeah, I was going to say, it would be a richer experience instead of somebody just pounding an issue
exactly.
at someone.
Exactly.
That
was sort of the idea. It took me a long time to figure out how to do that, partly because I didn't see myself as a playwright. And I didn't see myself creating that kind of theater. And so when I first graduated from college, I worked for the Sierra Club. I lived in Seattle, and it was the perfect place to do theater and environmental work. So I figured I could just split my time, work for an environmental organization and do theater on the side. And ended up also working for an educational theater company where we were touring shows about the Holocaust and immigration. And so doing stuff that was very kind of issues-oriented, human rights-oriented, felt like that was the way to go. Mm-hmm. I never dreamed of doing something like this Estrada Project until it actually happened.
Yes. Oh, and it's so fascinating. Listen, I know you've done some film. You had a part in Deception in The Apartment. Do you find yourself more attracted to theater, or would you give it all up if you got some big film career going?
Well,
do you have any idea?
Of course, if someone wanted to hand me Nicole Kidman's career, I wouldn't object. And the fantasy has always been, partly, I think, because of my background, being kind of your classic overachiever, and I went to Yale, and mm-hmm. I remember when I graduated, the president of the university talked a lot about Gorbachev, because I graduated from college in 1990, and, mm-hmm. you know, the Berlin Wall had just fallen,
yes.
And there was this sense that he was saying to us, if by any chance you happen to find yourself as the leader of a major totalitarian world power and have an opportunity to bring down the wall and bring democracy, you know, then go ahead and do that. So there's a sense of whatever you do, it's going to be on a large scale. You're going to be at the top of your profession.
Well, he must have been reacting to Ronald Reagan's theatrics around that. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall.
I'm not sure. But I definitely had this sense of to just go somewhere and have a personal life wasn't enough. And whatever I did, I had to be, you know, the great achiever.
Yeah.
The tricky part in that regard is that I am considered by the industry of show business to be extremely quirky, physically as a type.
Oh, just the type you
yeah.
want, not your politics or the fact that you want to mix politics. With,
no, because I didn't talk about that.
Okay.
You know, when I was working as an actor, I wouldn't talk about that. I'd just go in for an audition. But they would always say to me, wow, you're incredibly quirky, which makes me very hard to cast. Because I'm not so weird that they can just cast me as character types, and I'm not so cute that they can cast me as the ingenue. I was like the quirky ingenue for a long time.
You're sort of a Sarah Jessica Parker type in a way, to me.
Yes. In fact, that was what I heard all the time, every day, was, you know who you remind me of is Sarah Jessica Parker.
Exactly.
And I've been hearing that since she was in L.A. Story, when I was in college. And then she's on Sex and the City, and she's marketed as this kind of sex symbol. And so what I started hearing, and this is a direct quote from a commercial agent, wow, you're like an even quirkier Sarah Jessica Parker.
Oh.
Because somehow she'd been legitimized by Sex and the City. So I all of a sudden became the weirdo Sarah Jessica Parker.
Now, that can be worse things, Catherine.
There certainly could. And I love her. I think she's fantastic. And if someone wanted to hand me her career, too, that would be just fine. But nobody was doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And I struggled a lot with the fact that what's available to an actor? Well, if you're going to make any money, you have to do TV and commercials. And most TV is insipid.
Oh, it is.
And
absolutely.
Commercials, I hate commercials. And I thought I had solved the problem by doing what most actors do, saying, you know, the money from this career will allow me to do the stuff that I care about.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw Bowling for Columbine.
Ah.
And Michael Moore has this whole conversation about how the whole purpose of advertising is to instill fear so that people will go out and buy stuff. And I thought, I can't be a party of that.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't. I have a huge issue with capitalism in general, and, you know, I just can't engage that dynamic.
Yeah, this culture of fear is really, really irritating to me.
And I've also never been able to maintain myself at 20 pounds underweight, which means that TV and film is not as available to me as...
And isn't that a sad testament?
Oh,
that you
yeah.
have to be anorexic in order to succeed?
And not everybody does, but it makes it a lot harder. And I had another direct quote from an agent. I asked him what I could do to make myself more marketable, and he said, you know, you're beautiful, you're talented, you could be in better physical shape.
No.
And I'm not a heavy person, but
no,
I'm
not
underweight.
You're quite tiny, actually.
And...
But let's fast forward.
So that makes stage that much more appealing because the rigors, those sort of external rigors are not quite as severe as they are for TV and film.
Yeah, you're
so
right about
I've
that.
Naturally gravitated towards stage for that reason also because I feel less apologetic about myself
physically.
Well,
you also have to use your body more in theater than you do in film. It seems to me in direct relation to the audience. In film, they do close-ups
right.
and they do all this editing and... You know,
yeah.
So you have to be at least there present for a longer period of time when you're doing theater
and
actually hone a skill in some ways.
I've seen a lot of kind of skinny model types who look great in close-up but don't know how to walk across a stage and chew gum at the same time. And so, you know, there are definitely different sets of skills that are required.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
also, I think, as a stage actor, have to love language.
Absolutely.
More. And I, of course, love language. And it's part of what engaging my identity as a writer It's why that engagement has been so exciting, because mm-hmm. I realize I have a lot to say. And that's the other thing. I was turning down a lot of scripts in New York because I thought the writing was terrible. Yeah. And it wasn't saying anything that I wanted to say.
But I want to fast forward now to the year 2002, when you were a frustrated, out-of-work actor, upset over Bush's impending war in Iraq.
Yeah.
What happened next?
Well, what happened was that I was working for a transcription service, transcribing the raw interviews from shows like Dateline and 60 Minutes. And I was listening to all of these interviews talking about the impending disaster with the Middle East, and particularly if we went to war in Iraq. But, you know, we didn't know what the weapons of mass destruction situation was, but everyone was predicting that going to war was... So I was just wildly opposed to what was going on. And it also felt like the Bush administration had completely co-opted the mainstream media, and that there was no way for the voice of opposition to be heard. And you were hearing a lot of stuff like, if you disagree with the president at a time of war, you're a traitor.
And they're still trying to pull
that. And I was hearing things like, the entire Muslim world believes that all Americans hate Muslims and that we're all behind Bush. And that kind of stuff was making me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to figure out a way to get involved in the anti-war movement in a way that was satisfying. It also happened at the time that a friend and I were working on a screenplay that was a modern environmental adaptation of Lysistrata. So the original play, it's the Peloponnesian War, and the women decide to try to stop this 20 years war by going on a sex strike until the men quit fighting. And they're successful. The other thing that they do is they take over the Acropolis where all the money is stored, figuring if you can't fund the war, you can't have the war. And so I was trying to do an environmental version. First Lady of the United States starts a sex boycott to save the planet. And then I heard about this group, Thought, that had just gotten started, Theaters Against War, and they were planning a big day of action on March 2nd, hopefully before war would get started, mm-hmm. where they wanted theater people to do something for that day. And so I thought, hey, I'll do a reading of the screenplay. Deadline, always useful. And then I realized that I wasn't going to make it in time and that we weren't far enough along. And then I thought, well, why not just do a reading of the play? And it happened that the day I got this idea, which was January 4th of 2003, I thought, well, where could I do a reading? Because I didn't have a lot of money. I couldn't rent a big theater. And then I remembered that a friend of my husband's was the casting director at a small theater in New York. And I thought, well, maybe she could get them to donate the space.
Mm-hmm.
I get to work. I happen to get an email directly from her asking me and my husband to bring her to Vermont to do a show at my husband's theater. And I said, well, I can't help you with that, but I'm thinking of doing this reading of Lysistrata. Would you like to help me with that? Sharon Bauer is her name. And Sharon said, yes, absolutely. And we then started, over the next 24 hours, having a series of yes and conversations. Well, what if we did this? Yeah, and what if we did that? And what if we did that? And, you know, we felt really strongly that we needed to make up for the destruction that we had already wrought upon
mm-hmm.
Iraq,
mm-hmm.
both through the first war, through the sanctions, through the depleted uranium, all that kind of stuff. So we thought, well, why don't we do our reading as a benefit for humanitarian aid in Iraq? And one of the organizations that we picked was Madre, which mostly works in Latin America, but they had a program giving milk and medicine to kids in Iraq. And then we realized that Madre's spokesperson was Susan Sarandon. And wow, what if we cast her as Lysistrata? You know, and started having these, you know, but it kind of blew into this huge fantasy of what if we did more than one reading? What if we got all our friends to do readings? Because everybody must be frustrated about what's going on and the fact
and
that there's no voice of opposition. Yeah,
absolutely.
And they were.
Mm-hmm.
So we put, over the course of about a week, we put together a website that was a how-to kit for doing a reading of Lysistrata. Her husband was a graphic designer, came up with a great logo for us. We emailed everyone we knew. And everyone we knew thought it was a great idea. And they emailed everyone that they knew. And we got a flood of response within no time at all. And it just kind of grew from there. So I got the idea originally about midday on Saturday the 4th. The evening of Sunday the 5th, after we decided that this is what we were going to do, I emailed Susan Stamberg through the NPR website.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
Because she loves theater, her son's an actor, and I thought, I'm going to let her in on the beginning of this what I think is a great idea. And it was an incredible act of hubris because we didn't have anything going on just yet. But mm-hmm. I thought, oh, what the heck?
Oh, absolutely.
The following Friday, I get a phone call from NPR. They want to interview us on All Things Considered the following week. And by the time they interviewed us the following week, we already had the website up, a bunch of readings all over the world, and had something going on so they could, you know. So
eventually you had readings all over the world in all 50 states.
All 50
states. And this
states
turned into a major movement.
In 59 countries on 6 continents. Yeah, we received massive international press.
Uh-huh.
And
you also got some hate mail, right?
Oh, we got a lot of hate mail.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
You know.
Is it the business
Saddam,
as usual stuff?
Dear Saddam-loving feminazis.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
but
you hate
I,
America and
exactly.
so on.
Exactly. But I wrote
forth.
Back
yeah.
to everybody who wrote to me.
Did you?
Yeah, because I felt like it was really important to try to engage them as human beings
uh-huh.
and to let them know exactly why we were doing this.
Mm-hmm.
We're not anti-military. It's not like we've forgotten 9/11. We just have something we want to say.
You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is Catherine Bloom. Do you want to continue talking about this major movement that happened when you started asking people to read Lysistrata?
Well, you know, it was funny. Like I said, I wrote back to everyone who wrote to me, including the people who wrote me hate mail. They generally didn't respond, although there was one kid in Chicago, about 24 years old, from a big Catholic family, about to go into the military.
Mm.
He kept writing me back. And we discovered that we were both environmentalists, and he had a particular hatred for littering. And he told me he would yell at people who litter. And I said, wow, I'm too shy to do that. I always have fantasies of, you know, going up to someone who drops a cigarette butt and saying, hey, you dropped this, but I can't do it. So I said, next time you yell at a litterer, yell for me. But I ended up having to stop writing with him because he would just tell me why I was wrong.
Oh. Yeah.
And it,
so it wasn't really a conversation.
Uh-huh. Yeah, but uh-huh. I was pleased that we got as far as we did.
That's nice. Well, yeah, you might have changed a little something in him.
Tell
me how this great movement that happened turned into the one-woman show, the Accidental Activist. Because you were originally depressed because this war was starting. You start this movement, the war started anyway, correct?
Yeah, so. Yeah. And I didn't really know what I was going to do next.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a solo piece, the first draft of which I had written about a year before. And I thought, well, maybe it's time to get back to the solo piece. And maybe I'll work on it over the next month or two. And generally, I would spend September to May in New York and then go up to Vermont for the summers and spend summers with my husband. And so mm-hmm. I thought, well, before I leave at the end of May, I will do maybe a staged reading of this solo piece. And then what happened is that so the war started on the 19th. So Lysistrata Project was the 3rd of March. There was about 2 weeks in there. About a week after Lysistrata Project, things had gotten very, very quiet, and I was, you know, wondering what was going on. And I got an email from a woman who ran a theater company who I'd met when I was searching for producers for our big Lysistrata reading in New York. And she said, my theater company has its spring show going up at the end of May, or the end of April, but we normally run in repertory with another company to share expenses, and this other company has pulled out, and I'm looking for someone who has a show they want to put up in a very short period of time.
That's a real short period of time.
Yeah. Do you know of anybody? And like an idiot, I said, yes, I do. I have a show I want to put up. And I was going to have to raise a bunch of money to do it, and I didn't know how I was going to do that, but I thought, what the heck, I might as well just go for it. So the war started on the 19th. It was a Wednesday. That Saturday, I took the train to Vermont and spent 10 days rewriting the script, finding a production team, mostly from people who'd been involved in the Lysistrata Project in New York, some of the people I hadn't even met. I just emailed everyone who was on my list.
Mm-hmm.
And I found a director. And after 10 days, I came back with about 50 pages of a big mess. And we spent the next few weeks reworking the script. We staged it in a really short period of time and threw it up on the stage. And it was the most terrifying process I've ever been in.
Really?
Because mm-hmm. it was the first time I'd done something that I'd written myself. I was still memorizing the day we opened. The run-through the afternoon before we opened was probably the worst run-through in the history of run-throughs, short of somebody actually dying. But, you know, the magic
and
of theater.
And you also made yourself vulnerable, too. I mean, you show in this show how frustrated you were,
yeah,
unhappy you
yeah,
were
and,
because
and,
you weren't making it as an actress
and
so on.
It's also sort of, you know, it's a little bit theatricalized for dramatic purposes.
Oh, absolutely.
So
and it's
I
very
come
funny.
Up looking perhaps a little worse than I actually was. But my director kept saying, don't worry, they'll love you for it. And the show was extremely well received.
Mm-hmm.
And I did 10 performances in New York, and we got great reviews, and we got good audience, and people really loved it. And so I thought, well, why don't I take this on tour? And I started emailing peace and justice groups around the country. I emailed the national spearheads for Lysistrata Project, people who'd mm-hmm. organized readings. And I started touring the show. And I've been to almost a little over 30 cities now.
So has this been a cathartic experience for you, or are you still frustrated? I mean, this obscene war is still going on, and in some ways it hasn't affected much change,
you know,
as we would all wish by our actions, you know?
There's a duality there. I could not possibly hate the Bush administration any more than I do on pretty much every single front. They are an affront to everything that I care about
Me
and
too.
Everything that I treasure and hold dear.
Absolutely.
However, my husband pointed out the other day, well, we were having this conversation, and he said, so who do you know personally whose life is better because Bush is in office? And I had to answer truthfully, me. Because if that administration had not been so flagrantly obscene in their behavior, I would probably still be
looking at the wand
ads, transcript typing actor in New York. And instead, I have come full circle to creating relevant theater, which is what I really cared about all along.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a reputation, and both as the sort of co-founder of Liz Estrada Project, but also as a writer now and a solo performance artist. Making funny, relevant theater. I'm working on a new piece that I've mm-hmm. gotten a tremendous amount of support for.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I want to talk to you about that in a few minutes, yeah.
The career that I wanted is not the career that I have, but the career that I have happens to be tremendously satisfying. So I don't have Nicole Kidman's career,
but you have
neither
Catherine
does she
Blooms.
Have mine.
Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely.
And,
I can't imagine really wanting to be as famous as Nicole Kidman. It seems like kind of a trap.
There's a huge price to pay.
Yeah. You know what I want to ask you as well? Is the accidental activist in transition, or is it is the script in concrete now, or does it ever change?
Oh, no, it's changed a lot mm-hmm. because, you know.
And will it continue to?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think so, because when I first wrote it, we had just gone to war. And there was a lot of stuff that hadn't been made public, which is now common knowledge. Mm-hmm. So actually, as we've been working on it for this production in Ithaca, we cut a whole section just because the director said, you know, we know all this stuff now.
Ah.
You know, we know that they've auctioned off Iraq's infrastructure to multinational corporations. We know that they're dropping depleted uranium bombs. We know everything that's going on. The challenge of stopping it is still great, but mm-hmm. it's not news anymore. You know, it's not the same kind of news.
Have you gotten reaction in theaters where you've performed this that were ever negative? Did people start booing or
reacting at all? I had one performance in Boone, North Carolina, which is kind of the buckle of the Bible Belt. And I think there were a lot of, it was at a college there, and I think there were a lot of students who'd been assigned to come see the show. Uh-huh. And about halfway through, I felt like I was dragging a really wet carpet behind me.
That's
but
a great way of describing.
There was, you know, they didn't have the energy of the audience kind of propelling me along. But I've never had any aggressive objection. And in fact, I had a student come up to me once and say, you know what, I don't agree with your politics, but I really admire you for what you did.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that anyone seeing the show could make the distinction between my personal politics and the story of someone trying to take action in their life.
Yeah, I think it's a great, great message. And I also sensed in your script that you were sort of making fun of yourself too. This huge world-changing thing happening, and you were saying that you wanted to be the best actor of your generation, as declared by Vanity Fair,
right.
And it seemed like such a small little thing to want, considering this catastrophic thing that you're writing about, you know?
Well, it's crazy. And all along, as I've been pursuing a theater career, you know, when I first got out of college, I went to work for the Sierra Club.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for a number of different environmental organizations. And I stopped because theater was more emotionally compelling to me, as, you know, that hits my artist soul in a way that lobbying doesn't. And community organizing doesn't. And yet, I've been very conscious of the fact that the level of ecological destruction and the danger that we're facing has been increasing. And I've felt a tremendous amount of guilt for being selfish enough to pursue a theater career.
Hmm.
And I realize that, you know, not everyone has to be a lobbyist or an ecological activist in that way. You know, what we need are people who, whatever they do it with an environmental ethic in mind. And I used to give that speech when I worked for the Sierra Club, you know, I'd go and talk to the Chamber of Commerce and I'd say, you know, you guys can be exactly who you are, but you just need to do it with this, you know, with this ethos. Mm-hmm. And yet, to be that conscious and to feel like I wasn't doing anything was, you know, I hate to be dramatic about it, but it was kind of tormenting.
Mm-hmm.
Because I watch the ice caps melting, I watch all this stuff going on, I watch the rainforest being decimated, and I think, I'm not stopping this. I am not stopping this. And I felt a lot, when I was in New York, I'm wasting my time. I'm auditioning for crap, and I'm working at this dumb day job, and I'm apart from my husband, and if it were just one of those things, that would be okay, I could handle that. But to have nothing be meaningful, to mm-hmm. nothing contribute to the well-being of the world felt really awful.
So let's talk about the new solo show that you're working on. It's called Boycott?
The Boycott. That's the working title, yeah.
What is this about?
Well, it's that screenplay that I was working on, the modern environmental Lysistrata story. I realized that I don't have a lot of contacts in the film industry, and the likelihood of me getting a screenplay written, sold, and produced to my personal preferences would probably be pretty slim. Although, George Clooney, if you're out there, I think we could have a beautiful relationship. But the likelihood of me getting a solo piece written and produced is really high. And so I decided to turn it into another one-woman show. And so the nice part is that while I was sort of intending to get rolling on it, I got a grant from a theater in Burlington to do the first round of development on it.
Wow,
and then, great. And so that'll happen. The first sort of presentation of work in progress is going to happen in June. And then I've been invited to an artist residency in Hungary this summer to continue work on the script.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
to tell us a little bit about what it's about, though.
Well, the First Lady of the United States starts a sex boycott to save the planet.
Oh, so that you are going to pursue that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly the way you have spoken about it before.
Yeah.
I see.
And what's been funny as I've been working on it is that, you know, in a way it plays a little bit like an extended West Wing episode. You know, these very smart people in the White House do these things. But all of these tertiary characters have been creeping into the story and giving it more a feeling of magical realism, which is something that I really love.
Yeah.
So, you know, a friend of mine told me about, she heard a story on NPR about Brazilian tree frogs who have a horrible skin disease because with global warming, there's actually more cloud cover.
Oh.
And their skin can't dry out enough and they get this mold. And so one of the characters is a Brazilian tree frog searching for the sun. And as I hear about things, they tend to work their way into the show. And so I'm not exactly sure, of course, how it's all going to sort out. The show is slated to be part of Vermont Stage's 07-08 season, so I've got a little bit of time to figure it out. But it's been a lot of fun to work on, and terrifying at the same time, because it means I have to research global warming.
That
and
is
it's
scary.
Not that I'm not thinking
when
about it
already.
When you find
out how extensive it is, you're probably going to be shocked.
I spend a lot of time reading, writing, crying.
Oh, I'll bet.
But
I'll
the other bet. Neat part is that there's a company called Native Energy, which does carbon offset through building wind farms in Native American reservations in North Dakota. And they've agreed to be the carbon offset sponsor for this first round of development. And so I'm building partnerships with organizations that are on the ground doing the work of making things better. And that's really exciting.
You know what this reminds me of? The First Ladies doing a sex boycott. Remember in the 60s, Joan Baez and her sisters
did that poster.
Girls say no to the draft. Yeah.
And well, apparently, I think it was William Sloan Coffin's wife used to run around. I think it was, and don't quote me on this, but I think it was her who ran around Vietnam War protests wearing a placard saying Lysistrata anyone. So the idea
really?
Has been around, yeah.
It has been around many centuries.
Many centuries, and as we were working on Lysistrata project, we would hear from people saying, you know, we're already doing a production of Lysistrata, so count us in.
We are running out of time. I just want to remind our listeners that they can see Kathryn Bloom in The Accidental Activist at the Kitchen Theater through May 13th. And if you want to get in touch with the Kitchen Theater, it's kitchentheater.org.
And that's theater with an R-E, the British style.
That's right. And so thank you so much for being with us,
Kathryn
Bloom.
Oh, my pleasure.
Bloom. And good luck with your future projects.
Thank you so much.
Our audio producer is Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.